Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Judiciary Committee, so I guess officially we'll come to order. Today we have a number of bills for public hearing and work session. We also have some bills that are designated for work session only. Just to let everyone know, we are not rushing to move everything out of here. We have plenty of time. I am going to ask for some dialogue on a couple of the bills and some of the work sessions, just so we can make certain we have a broader picture of what is on the table. And so I'm going to ask Council, do we have an order of where we want to start? All right, so we're going to start with House Bill 3380A. I have Representative Williamson that's going to help lead off. And it looks like Representative Pelosi, if I can read Josh's writing. So why don't y'all two come on up? I'm going to go ahead and open up that public hearing on 3380A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3380A modifies the Family Sentencing Alternative Pilot Program. The bill authorizes the court to consider eligibility for the program as a mitigating factor that would support a downward departure from a prison sentence. In addition, the bill eliminates criminal history-based eligibility requirements and provides eligibility for offenders who are pregnant at the time of sentencing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Ladies?
Good morning, Chair Prezanski and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carla Peluso. I represent House District 50 in Gresham. I am proud to testify in strong support of House Bill 3380 and the Family Sentencing Alternative Program today. As you know, I'm a former police chief who spent 30 years in law enforcement. When I arrested women with their children watching, I knew I was altering their lives forever. Many of these mothers were in domestic violence situations or struggling with addiction or mental illness. I also knew that if these parents were sent to prison, their children would most likely end up in foster care. I believe in holding people accountable when they make bad choices, but I know that when it comes to holding people accountable, we have effective alternatives to incarceration that have been better outcomes for individuals, their children, and their communities. That is why I am so encouraged by diversion programs like the Family Sentencing Alternative. This program allows eligible participants to remain united with their children while receiving intensive supervision and services that will help them become better parents and better community members. During my time in law enforcement, I saw so many parents and families who could have benefited from a program like this. Through House Bill 3380, we have the opportunity to expand eligibility for this program and ensure that it is being used as an actual diversion tool so that more families stay together and less children enter the foster care system. I thank you for your time, and I urge your support.
All right. Thank you, Representative Williamson.
Thank you, Chair Prezanski. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jennifer Williamson. I'm the state representative for House District 36, which is Northwest and Southwest Portland. The Family Sentencing Alternative Program was passed in 2015 with broad bipartisan support, and the bill we have in front of you today passed out of the House Judiciary Committee unanimously and off the floor of the House unanimously. This initiative was designed to provide parents with intensive supervision and services instead of prison so they can achieve accountability while strengthening bonds with their children and increasing family stability. This has real long-term implications for our communities, as research shows that children of incarcerated parents are much more likely to find themselves incarcerated at some point. Since the inception of the five-county pilot program for the family alternative sentencing here in Oregon, in January of 2016, 75 individuals have participated in this program with a total of 139 children. The ultimate goal has been to reduce recidivism and to save prison beds. Though the program is too new for the Department of Corrections to report on outcomes, they have noted positive changes in the individuals who are participating in this program. That said, the 2015 bill has not worked out quite the way it was intended as a downward departure dispositional tool. That is a problem when a sentence may call for prison time. Many participants in this program are individuals who would otherwise have been sentenced to probation time instead of jail. This legislation would specifically allow a court to consider eligibility in the Family Sentencing Alternative Program as a mitigating factor when determining a sentence. Gaps in the law also unintentionally excluded parents who otherwise would be eligible for the program. House Bill 3380 would allow qualified parents, particularly women who are pregnant at the time of sentencing, to be reunited with their families while receiving intensive supervision and community-based treatment. This way, newborns have the chance to bond with their moms. In alignment with the recommendations from the Public Safety Task Force, the Department of Corrections will be given the authority to determine county participation in the program. As we consider whether or not to open another women's prison in Oregon, programs like this, if properly applied and implemented, can save the state substantially while improving the outcomes for individuals participating. I believe this bill would ensure that the program continues to meet its intended goals of being used as an effective diversion tool and to save taxpayer dollars. I strongly urge your support for this bill. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for either of the representatives? All right, let me just put on the table, we're probably going to be hearing this from other individuals. As you probably know, we passed Senate Bill 895, and so now we have House Bill 3380. They're very similar. There are some differences. I don't know if either of you want to make any comments on that. I think, lifelines that will be coming up to go in more detail, so I just want to give you an option if you want to say something between the two comparison. If not, we'll wait until we get other people up.
Chair Przanski, for the record, my concern between the two bills is the authority of between the two bills is the authority for the court to apply a downward departure in order to allow people who are otherwise eligible for the program to apply that downward departure, and I believe that's an important tool for the court to be able to use.
Okay. All right. Any other comments or questions? All right. So I will let y'all stand down if you're ready to do that. You're more than welcome to stay. We'll go ahead and pull some other people up because I want to go into some more detail of some stuff that's come up. Thank you. So we have Jeff Wood, Katie Roller, and I've got three more. Why don't y'all two come on up? And I think I'm going to do this in panels of two right now. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Wood. I'm a Parole and Probation Division Commander with the Marion County Sheriff's Office. I am here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, and we are in support of House Bill 3380, the A engrossed version. As has been previously stated very articulately, the legislature's passage of House Bill 3503 created a 10-year pilot project for the Family Sentencing Alternative Program to divert qualified offenders to enhance supervision, parenting classes, and supports that they would not otherwise get on the community. Based on that successful Washington State program, our end goal is to reduce recidivism. It is designed to reduce the female population, but also create family stability within our communities and successful outcomes. While our pilot program in Oregon has showed promise, the original pilot was limited to five counties: Washington, Multnomah, Marion, Deschutes, and Jackson County, if I remember correctly. And while we believe that the initial phase of the pilot has shown successful outcomes, we do support the expansion of the bill and removing some of the sideboards of the bill. Locally in Marion County, we have experienced a couple of cases which we believe through our district attorney's office that people should be eligible for those cases. I will say we even gave it the collegial try, trying to get one case through, which the Department of Corrections said, no, you can't do. Candidly, and I know I have my friends in the Department of Corrections behind me, they made the right decision. That case was not eligible. We hope by removing some of these sideboards, we will be able to include more people. Locally in Marion County, I believe we have about 25 cases, roughly 50 children that we're currently serving. We provide parenting classes, coordinated case management, trauma-informed care, and a variety of services designed not only to address the individual, both male or female, depending on who's involved in the case, but also to restore the family and look at the holistic version of that family for the future so that, one, children are not re-traumatized by the parents going into the Oregon Department of Corrections for a period of incarceration, but work with them so that, one, we can address the criminality, but maybe more importantly, address the intergenerational cycle of criminality so that families do not repeat the mistakes of their past. Some of you may be aware, locally in Marion County, our Jail and Transition Center survey that we do every 2 years indicated that 70% of our clients are parents, 51% of the population reported a mental health diagnosis, 60% report abuse of drugs or alcohol, and startlingly, 87% of our female population reports some form of sexual or physical violence. With these issues in mind, we believe that in order to break that intergenerational cycle of criminality, it's very important to ensure children remain connected to their parents and receive services designed to treat both them, the individual, and the family. On behalf of OACCD, we do look forward to working with the Department of Corrections to expand the FSAT programs, and we will be supportive of it anyway. The one thing I will mention, and I believe the Department of Corrections will mention this too, there is, in the engrossed version, it does still appear that the person felony is defined by the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, still disqualifies an individual as part of the FSAP sentencing program. I will say locally in Marion County, criminal mistreatment, I'm not a lawyer, I guess I'm pretending to be right now, still, I believe, would disqualify individuals for that program. Locally in Marion County, that is a charge that we commonly see for the type of client that would need these type of services, and we believe it should be eligible within this program. And with that, I will turn it over to my colleague. Right, unless there are questions, I apologize.
Well, we're going to do questions after Katie gives hers. But Katie, before you give your testimony, can you give me a ballpark about how much time you need?
I would say 3 minutes.
All right, why don't we go ahead and take your testimony, and then what we're going to do, we're going to break before we take questions. Representative Sanchez is here, and I forgot and neglected. I want to get her testimony on another bill so she can go and, on to her other duties for the day. Katie?
Chair Prozanski, Co-Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, my name is Katie Roller, and I'm the Community Justice Manager overseeing the Family Sentencing Alternative Program in Multnomah County. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. Multnomah County is one of the five counties participating in the current Family Sentencing Alternative pilot program. So far, we've served about 30 individuals in Multnomah County with this program. Multnomah County strongly supports House Bill 3380A because it will eliminate some of the restrictions to program participation. We could serve more clients and possibly even have a wait list to this program if the barriers are removed. The most important aspect of this program is that participants are able to continue parenting their children in the community and not housed in prison. After an initial assessment and while receiving intensive supervision and wraparound services, Multnomah County manages these individuals in the community with the help of our public safety and community partners. Multnomah County's Family Sentencing Alternative Pilot Program is located within our Family Services Unit. This unit provides supervision through a multidisciplinary team, working closely with child welfare, human services, health services, and mental health agencies. Services include alcohol and drug, mental health, trauma, and culturally specific treatment, as well as parenting classes. Additionally, our participants are paired with a parenting mentor, and if needed, the child receives a mentor also. Based on our experiences, the FSAP program clearly addresses the needs of the individuals and their families. Jackie, a mother who's participating in the program, recently said that being in FSAP has given me a chance to do right by my babies. Officer Combs, who is the parole and probation officer that supervises this caseload, has said that working closely with community partners to increase success for our clients and positively impact the children while maintaining accountability and community safety is what she likes the most about the program. In summary, I respectfully request that you support House Bill 3380A so that more offenders can participate in this program, benefiting them, their families, and the community at large. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
All right, thank you, Katie. What I'm going to do is recess. If y'all want to just stand down just for a moment, I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing for the purpose of taking Representative Sanchez's testimony on House Bill 3438A. And Josh, is this yours?
It is. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3438A directs the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision to consider an offender's eligibility for transitional housing programs and residential treatment programs when determining whether to waive the requirement that offenders must spend the first 6 months of supervision in the county in which they resided at the time of the offense. In addition, the bill requires the supervisory authority to include in an offender's release plan any transitional housing or treatment programs to which the offender has been accepted. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. And Representative Sanchez, I apologize for not calling you up after we took the representative's testimony on the other bill, but we'd love to get your testimony now.
Thank you so much. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Vice Chair Thatcher. My name is Tana Sanchez. I'm the state representative for House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. House Bill 3438 came about because, well, I've been a volunteer in Coffee Creek Correctional Facility for many, many years and other facilities throughout the state, working with people transitioning out of the prison system and really hopefully helping people to avoid recidivism. So one of the things that was a big struggle was recognizing that when people were required to return to the county that they came from, so essentially under current law, a person is released on post-prison supervision, they default to the county that they either that they were prosecuted from. So for the first 6 months, they have to return to that county. Very often, that county may not have the facilities that they need in terms of transitional or treatment programs. Very often, that county may be just, you know, obviously the place where they struggled with the most, dealing with addictions and issues of just poverty or whatever it was that kept them from being able to be a good, decent person and making their progress in the world. So oftentimes people really struggle with having to go back to those counties without those resources. The State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision may waive this requirement for a number of reasons, including for good cause or when a treatment program does not exist in the county in which the person is scheduled to return. Let me just say from my perspective as a social worker and an alcohol and drug counselor, I know that that's so very, very important for people to have that consideration. This bill, that's what that would provide, is just a greater opportunity to have that consideration and make it not just an, well, let me just also say, if somebody has made the effort, done the work in prison prior to their release to say, hey, I want to go to this treatment program, or has met, I know that we have many organizations, both, you know, faith-based organizations and treatment organizations that go into the prison and do a lot of volunteer work, and they have those opportunities to connect with people and hopefully make a connection that says, I want to really be able to help you get out of here and do something different with your life in the future. If people can take those opportunities, I think that's an amazing thing to be able to happen. If they can't, because they can't be released to that county, that's a struggle. So we have made some amendments to the bill. We've been talking to the Department of Corrections and got their okay on a lot of things. There's already amendment in the that came from the House that was some concerns that corrections had that we dealt with around requiring. It's not a requirement. It's a consideration. So that's really, really important. At the suggestion of the chair, of course, we've asked for an amendment to add a reporting component to the bill. Department of Corrections says they're okay with that. They can do it with existing resources that they have. Yeah, that's it.
All right, hopefully. Thank you. Questions for the representative? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and just recess this one. We'll come back and get the rest of the testimony on House Bill 3438A. We're going to come back in on from recess on House Bill 3380A. And Jeff and Katie, if you two would be kind enough to come back up. And as they're getting situated, there are a couple of things that I wanted to kind of put on the record as to having some discussions on, and it's the differences between the two bills. And one of them, I think, Jeff, you acknowledged that, and that is basically who would be eligible for the program if they're in the particular on line one, excuse me, page one, line 14 of the, I think of the 3380 has the prohibition as to someone being a person felon. And the bill that we've already passed, colleagues, on Senate Bill 895 does not have that restriction. So that's one area. And then the other area that I expect that we're going to have some concerns when we hear from ODAA is on page 2 of 3380, lines 2 through 5, which talks about this being potentially a mitigating factor. So I will just pose those out there. I'm not sure if you have any comment. You may not. It may be just for other individuals who will be testifying later.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I haven't had a moment to read the bill 895, other than making the comment about locally in Marion County, that charge, criminal mistreatment, is often connected to services that we have, like Multnomah County, we have a specialized unit that deals with cases like these. In a perfect world, we would love to have them sentenced as part of the family sentencing alternative program, but they can't just because of the nature of the crime. And that is something, as I said, good-naturedly, that we gave it the collegial try, didn't work. The Department of Corrections rightfully said, no, it doesn't qualify. But that even with some of these changes, that tends to be one of the barriers for us presently.
All right. Thank you.
Chair, is also a barrier in Multnomah County. We've had to turn away several clients based on the criminal mistreatment charge, and they appear to be the people that would benefit the most from being in this intensive supervision program.
All right. Thank you. Senator Denborough first. Any other questions?
Thanks. I'd like to follow up on that, example that you mentioned. I wonder if you could tell us a little more about the individuals who were not able to be included, and I would assume that a concern in putting that prohibition in originally was that they would be dangers because of their record. Could you talk about why, what would it take to alleviate that concern on our parts?
Senator Denborough, Chair Przanski, members of the committee, specific to the case I'm thinking of, it really was charge specific. I don't want to allude that that case went to the Department of Corrections in lieu of being a part of the program. I think what would have been nice for this case, again, would have been to provide those enhanced services. They're still getting supervision, treatment, mentoring, parenting. But I will say the collaboration with the Department of Human Services, Child Welfare is an important factor. And candidly, they have resources that we don't too, where that coordinated case planning is probably one element that I would say that individual would benefit from. We have a fantastic district attorney in Marion County. He and his office support this program, and like I said, they're willing to give it the collegial try. I just think with some of these barriers, we have faith in the district attorney's office to determine which cases they believe are appropriate. In turn, we will initiate our assessments based on those referrals, and through our internal processes, this individual, we believe, could have done well. I will say that an individual is still doing okay, but I think they would have benefited from some of those enhanced services.
And Senator and Chair, I agree also. What we see is that the people that have the criminal mistreatment are still being supervised, but it's that multidisciplinary team where the PO is meeting with the parenting mentor, is meeting with the therapist, is meeting with Department of Human Services, and they're coming up with a case plan. They're able to set up parenting time where the PO can monitor that parenting time along with the parenting mentor and the therapist, just to make sure that the person is getting those extra skills and that extra attention, and we don't have that if they're not in the program.
Any follow-up? Senator Lithicum.
With regard to the numbers that you mentioned 30 participants today in the program, and then your comment was some 70% of the population that you're seeing come through your office were parents. Mm-hmm. What would that look like if 70% of those people all participated in this program? In terms of what these sound like enormous numbers to me.
Mm-hmm. Senator Lithicum, and forgive me if I butchered your last name. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, is I believe we would at least, very conservative numbers. If say sideboards were removed and people who qualified. including, say, criminal mistreatment, I would guess minimum 20% increase. And so with that, you know, I'd say 4 or 5 additional people, 8 to 10 additional children. And I think that's very conservative. I just don't want to lead the committee into any sort of false numbers. But that would have, I think, a significant impact and be able to make that program. Our parole probation deputy who's assigned to the unit does a fantastic job, but it would be able to, you know, economy of scale, so to speak. We're receiving funding from the Department of Corrections, and we're ready for more cases. And I think it would make that program more robust and hopefully make our outcomes, not that they are anything less than positive, but more positive.
With regard to the requirement that a defendant participating is one thing, acquiring the skill sets is something else. What's on the backside to ensure that, aside from more parole and probation, to ensure that skill sets are actually acquired?
Senator Lithgow, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, maybe I will just add, I think not only are the sort of the backside of supervision is important, but I would also say the initial screening is vitally important. Locally in Marion County, one of the first things we do is the district attorney is the gatekeeper of the referrals, and we do a variety of assessments, which I'm sure Multnomah County does too, where we ascertain the person's motivation to change, any prior supervision history, compliance on supervision. And so I think my point would be that not only do we need to have an appropriate filter on the front end, effective services, a balance of supervision, treatment, potential sanctions, but if we do an effective job on that front end, then while they're successful in the programming, and one of the things that we do for whether it's our prison diversion program or the family sentencing alternative, is we also understand that it takes a person 30 years to get to the point where they are now. Addiction doesn't happen overnight, nor will it ever stop overnight. And one of the things we realize is there will be short violations, understandable sanctions, not that we condone it, but it is sort of the root cause of human behavior. And so within that supervision period, it is important that we have available sanctions to address the violations. And we network with our district attorney to make sure, one, they're aware of this, two, that they support it. And so that at the front end, I'd say effective screening needs to be done. We need to have those enhanced services, coordinated care with department, DHS, and our supervision practices. Marion, like Multnomah, we are in what we call an EPICS County, Effective Practices in Community Supervision. It's a cognitive-based supervision plan for clients so that when they come in, they have a cognitive session during that brief period of time. But then also, as we sort of transition from intense supervision to more or less intense supervision and really the potential of getting off supervision, having an aftercare plan in place with a treatment provider, with DHS, so that we're all on the same page, so that the person can have that, I guess, the soft handoff to a less restrictive environment, but some monitoring to ensure that what we are trying to do with every individual and their children is still adhering to the end goals of the program.
All right. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you all very much for coming back up.
Thank you.
We're going to go ahead and call up Shannon White, Elizabeth Couchois.
Good morning, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Shannon White. I'm the Deputy Director with Partnership for Safety and Justice. We are a statewide nonprofit that advances solutions to crime that ensure justice, equity, accountability, and healing. And we do this by advocating for proven effective strategies for people who have committed crime, so victims of crime, and also people who have committed crimes. We're here today in support of House Bill 3380A. And rather than going through a lot of the details that you've already heard about the program, I will skip to why we are here specifically in support of this bill and over the 895 bill, which I know is a big question. I think you all have heard that this bill passed in 2015 with huge bipartisan support. Part of the reason the bill was brought at that time was because of the pressure on the female prison population, which I think you are all aware is an even worse situation now. The five pilot counties were given a total of $2 million to identify custodial parents to divert from prison into the counties. And part of the reason they were given those funds was, of course, to offset the need for a second prison for women and the increased pressure on our prison population. Now, we do hear, we have staff from our organization have visited four of the five pilot sites and interviewed people running the program there, and we did hear that, you know, some folks are they would have been probation eligible anyway, and then they might have been revoked, and this program has kept them from going to prison. So probably in some ways this program has done was it has intended, but largely it hasn't gotten to the population that we intended it for. And that's why there are the opening of the prior crime histories, which was based on recommendations from all of the pilot sites. And then this bill that we helped to bring includes the mitigating factors so that the court has an opportunity to downward depart people from that prison sentence rather than just put people in the program who are already going to get probation. So that is really why this bill is different, why we're pushing this hard. This is, as everyone said, about creating greater community safety and real accountability and support for custodial parents so they can stay united with their children and having them avoid going to foster care. And so I think that's all I need to say for now, given all that you've heard about the bill, but I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Elizabeth?
Hi, Elizabeth Kushwa, Children First for Oregon here. And you've heard a lot about diverting parents from prison and those services that the parents receive. I'm here to talk about the children who are in these families. Children are disproportionately affected and traumatized by the arrest, trials, convictions, and incarcerations of their parents. And this bill seeks to address some of those things. We all know that you've heard about ACEs scores, adverse childhood experiences. We know that this is a direct traumatizing event for a child. We also know that those ACEs scores lead to reduced educational attainment, which is the greatest link to poverty in adulthood. So this all really does come back to the children at the beginning. These wraparound services are crucially important for the families. We're talking parenting classes that are very important, keeping kids out of foster care. We all know that neglect is one of the major reasons for kids being in foster care. And so these kids having stronger parenting will be able to stay in the home and in the communities. We know that other bills have addressed this, as we've discussed today. We like the idea of this bill being expanded to those families who are most at risk and who need it the most. We also know that keeping kids out of the juvenile justice system is crucially important. Strong families are part of that. So Children First for Oregon hopes that you will join us in your support of 3380A. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel?
Well, Senator Thatcher. I don't know if this is a question for people sitting before us or somebody out in the audience, but I guess I'm just wanting an example of comparison of perhaps 895 and 3380 with a population or maybe an individual, where with 895 they would not be able to get the services, but under this one they would, and I would like to know how that would work, I guess.
I can start to speak to it, but obviously the people implementing the program might be better able to answer the question. But there are people who, you know, I'll say this. Part of what we went to is we went to Ledge Council and said, look, This bill isn't doing what it was intended to do. It's not reaching the population of people that are going to prison, that would have been going to prison, and that's who it was intended for. How can we address that? And after a lot of back and forth, the best suggestion that was given us was we need to allow the court some judicial discretion so that if someone comes into the court and is going to go to prison, the judge could say, hey, you're eligible for this program because of these other factors. You have children. You're here for these certain nonviolent crimes. Let's put you in this program and give you intensive support and services, where otherwise people less serious offenses, people would already be in probation, and right now they're just getting intensive services, which is fabulous, but honestly I think this body allocated $2 million to actually get to a higher risk population. Is that helpful?
And I guess the follow-up would be under 3380, having the DAs make that decision, I'm just trying to figure out what's the next.
So
it wouldn't work because
Vice Chair Thatcher, Chair Przanski. It's in our bill 3380A where the judge would have the decision. And so it's just giving a little extra, putting one extra party in the conversation about whether or not that person should be eligible.
Let me just clarify. So what we're talking about now is on page 2, lines 2 through 5 of the 3380. That's the portion of this bill that differs from 895, where it does in fact place the court in a position to take in consideration whether or not this program should be offered to someone as a downward departure and getting into these services, as compared to my interpretation, and we're going to have ODA up next, under 895, that is not an option for the court. It would take the district attorney's office in the county that they're serving, I guess, some type of agreement that maybe someone should be potentially downward departure. I'm not even sure if that could happen under 895, but clearly the court would not have that authority as it would under 3380. All right, any other questions? Ladies, thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and ask for Jeff McLean and Kevin Neely, if y'all please come forward. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, Kevin Neely, representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I've learned my lesson. I'm always going to show up at this table with a lawyer, and I'm happy to have one next to me today. Jeff McLean is the lawyer in the Washington County District Attorney's Office who handles this FSAP program, amongst many other programs he's charged with. I wanted to set the playing field a little bit for you guys. Obviously, there's been a lot of discussion about the differences between these two bills. You'll note we signed up in opposition to this bill. We were here in support of Senate Bill 895. Part of the reason that we were here in support of Senate Bill 895 is that that bill does, as has been described, expand the sideboards to this program. We believe the impediment that you've just heard described by Ms. White isn't a product of the DA being a gatekeeper. It's a product of there not being broad enough eligibility for the program. If we broaden the eligibility a little bit, we do believe we'll be able to fill the program. I would just want to give you a little bit of additional background, and I want to make a shameless plug for Oregon. The additional background is this program is modeled after a similar program in the state of Washington. They don't have a problem filling that program there because they send more people to prison than we do here in Oregon. One of the reasons we need to expand this program broader than is currently the case in Washington is because we typically don't send people to prison on PCS, as many of you know, and you have to have more predicate offenses to get in on a repeat property crime. And so a lot of the offenders that in other states would be eligible for this program and kept out of prison aren't going to prison here in Oregon. I've submitted written testimony. It shows some graphs that talk about that. So again, that's the shameless plug. I would then tell you that this program in the five pilot counties operates in
specific ways that have been designed by the participants in the county. And we really think that's a good way to manage this population. Let those folks in the county sit down and figure out how to run their own programs. And I would tell you, in four of the counties, the DA does have a strong say in who the participant is, but that say is really buoyed by recommendations from the probation and parole department and the defense attorneys. They're the ones that often come and say, hey, we think that this offender is a good candidate for this program. And then the DA takes a look at it and says, yeah, I think that might be the case, or one, or two. Often where they start is, I'm sorry, this person just doesn't meet the basic requirements because they have a criminal mistreatment. That's probably the most common example, which you just heard from Marion County. And so at that point, the DA doesn't say no because they don't want them to participate. They say no because they simply don't have the legal authority to allow them to participate. And we think that just giving them the legal authority to allow them to participate will probably remedy the challenge that we face. I would also say that in some counties, the judge does, in fact, heavily weigh in. And Washington County, sitting next to me, the judge kind of is the one that is leading the charge on this program. So there, in some counties, there may not even be that big a difference. And I'll conclude and then let the professional speak to you about the details of the program by saying this. You could move us from a no on this bill to a yes on this bill pretty simply. One, adopt Senate Bill 895, which we've already supported and was supported by the Public Safety Task Force that obviously you were a member of, Mr. Chair. Two, limit the sideboards on this bill. Right now, there's just no sideboards. You could be convicted of a serious, serious crime and have a very, very significant prior criminal history and still be eligible. So it maybe opens the door a little too wide. Or finally, eliminate that mitigating factor. Any one of those, not all of them, but any one of those probably pushes the ODAA into support of this program. We do believe it's a good program. We do believe that it's really helping keep these families together. And I would also just in conclusion add, do remember this is a program that doesn't just affect the female population. It affects both the men and women that are convicted. And so we want to make sure that we don't open the door too wide and unnecessarily include someone that may, in fact, imperil the program because they're just too dangerous to have in this program. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. McLean. He can answer technical questions and tell you how the program operates in Washington County.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Jeff McLean. I'm a deputy district attorney in Washington County, Oregon. I'm here on behalf of them as well as the ODAA. One of my roles as a felony prosecutor was I was assigned to begin this pilot program here in Washington County. It is a great program. So when I speak here this morning, and I'm going to narrow down what my concerns are about the current bill that's in front of you, it's not the program itself. I think there's a lot of benefits to that. I think I looked at statistics the other day. In our county, we had 27%, as of March of 2017, there were 27 participants in this program. Most of those were females, but there are also male participants in this program as well. I can address specifics how the program works in our county, but what I wanted to address first is what my main concern is as a prosecutor in Washington County and looking at the current proposed bill. And it's simply on line one, if you look at line 13, what had been removed from the bill previously was eligibility for the program, talking about a person who'd been previously convicted. So previously under the bill, if you've been previously convicted of a person felony or a sex crime or some other things that were listed, you would not be eligible. That sideboard has been removed. That is a concern to me as a prosecutor for the following reasons. If I'm evaluating an individual now in the bill in its current form that'd be eligible for that program, it would allow a person, whether they're male or female, because this is open for a parent, I'm male or female, that person could have a pretty violent prior criminal history and be eligible. That person could have a prior criminal history for convictions of manslaughter, murder, assault in the first degree. That person could have prior convictions for sex crimes, either against adults or children, of rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree. Those prior convictions, in the way that's currently phrased, those folks could be eligible, would be eligible for this program. Those are some of the concerns I have as a local prosecutor as far as eligibility is concerned of those individuals. I know there's been some issues addressed by parole and probation. They may have been addressed in front of this committee or at the House as well from probation departments in Washington County. And there may be some, I think, leeway as far as what prior felonies that would be allowed that are technically person felonies. I know some concerns that I've heard from parole and probation in our county was a few individuals that were not eligible because their previous conviction was a criminal mischief in the first degree, or criminal mistreatment, sorry, in the first degree. And specifically, it dealt with, if you look at the criminal mistreatment subsection, dealing where a child was left unattended in a circumstance there. Those could be addressed by just modifying the bill to some degree, but without as broad as it's written now, eligibility to go way beyond just an individual maybe who has that prior criminal conviction that we could address with, by simply modifying the bill to some degree. So I don't know if any folks have any questions for me, I'd be more happy to try to answer.
All right. Before, I just need y'all to walk me through, because when I'm looking at House Bill 3380 and comparing Senate Bill 895, on page 1 of 3380, Jeff, we're talking about that lines 13 and 14.
Right.
So my reading of that, it says the defendant, then we're removing, has not previously been convicted of, and then is not currently being sentenced for, then it basically says a person felony as defined.
Right.
Now, comparing that to 895 that ODA did, in fact, support, I'm looking at what the difference is here, and it appears that 895 is more, I hate to say liberal, but more open, because it does, in fact, take person felony out of that equation. So walk me through as to how it seems to me you would be more against 895 than against 3380.
I can address it first. I'll let Mr. Neely do it. I mean, personally, that's my concern across the board. So I'll just be very candid with the committee. Whether it's in the Senate bill, the other bill that you're talking about, or the other one, that would be my concern in either bill, is that removing that sideboard there. So I can candidly answer it that way, that I'd want to see it in either version. I'd like to see that put back in, you know, at least as far as some restrictions about person's prior criminal history, at least if we can limit what I call violent person felonies and serious sex offenses, person sex crimes.
Mr. Chair, I would add to what Mr. McClain said. It's interesting. Part of what I said is this is practiced differently on a county-by-county basis. What's unique about Washington County is there the judge does already consider mitigating. This is a mitigating factor. In all of the other participant counties, that is not the case. Why the program has developed in that way is unclear to me. And so while Senate Bill 895 probably opens the door too wide for Washington County, for all of the other participant counties, the DA has essentially had the authority kind of to say, no, this person's not the right fit. So it is an example of how I believe the passage of the bill was in 2015, wasn't maybe clear enough for every county, and the program has developed in a different way. And so as we were discussing it in the Public Safety Task Force, our understanding was that the DA really was maybe not the gatekeeper, but had kind of a veto authority. That's not how the program has developed in Washington County, but for the rest of the counties, they have had that role. Therefore, we were more open to the idea and continue to be open to the idea of a more expansive piece. I would also say we do believe that it's okay for some limited number of person crimes as the underlying crime, not the criminal history, to be included, because those folks ought to have the option of this program if it's a relatively minor infraction that's clearly an extension of the behavior that we're trying to correct in this FSAP program.
All right. Senator Manning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of wondering about the administration of these types of program. Who would that fall up under? Who would have the authority to recommend or refer someone to enroll in either of these programs?
Right. In Washington County, it can be one of three ways that the process begins. Obviously, you have a person that's in the court system at that point. It can be a recommendation that's done by our office. It can be done by the defense attorney. It can be done by parole and probation. So what typically what happens in our county is whoever makes that initial recommendation makes it to a specific probation officer that's assigned in our county for the FSAP program. Then they will honestly send me an email and tell me if this person's eligible for the program. What we use in Washington County is for eligibility was the previous bill. I would go through and simply look at, hey, is there anything in their past criminal history that makes them ineligible? Does the current crime make them ineligible? And if there's those answers were no to those two questions, in essence, then I would refer back to the probation department and say this person's potentially eligible. Now, there can be other things that can come up depending on the nature of the crime, but at that point, then that they would go forward and basically continue with their investigation of the individual. That person wanted to be a participant. They would gather the background information of that person. And what happens in Washington, that parole and probation officer will write a report in regards to that person's eligibility, whether they think they'd be a good candidate or not a good candidate. And then typically, if we're at a sentencing stage, whether that individual, then it's basically a decision of that individual DA who knows that case well, knows the specifics of that case, may know other details, whether they're opposing, let's say it's a property crime sentence where the presumptive sentence could be a prison sentence or not. We would make our decision. Sometimes we would be in agreement, say this person would be eligible for this program. That's great. Even if we're not, for example, let's say the individual DA for some reason had concerns about that, it's what we view as a discretion of the court. We make our recommendation, the defense would make theirs, and then the judge would make the decision whether that person would be eligible for a downward departure. And we've had our judges look at the FSAP program and say, look, as a mitigating factor to depart that prison person from, let's say, a presumptive prison sentence based upon a property offense, I'll find that this person's eligible for an FSAP program. I've had judges do that in cases I've seen. So they will use that as a factor in that report because they believe it's a program that there's a treatment program available, and they'll make those appropriate findings.
Okay, follow up. So based on that criteria, mm-hmm. the way that you design or describe the process, then along with having everybody having a say-so mm-hmm. based off, I'm kind of wondering now is what is the opposition as the bill is written then, because you have multiple layers that's going to be recommending or opposing a person from going into it at multiple levels. Right. So I'm trying to understand why you would be, if there's an individual that has committed a felony mm-hmm. or something like that, mm-hmm. the way you just define this is that you will provide a recommendation whether or not this person qualifies for a program or not. And then there are other mitigating factors or steps involved in this. So mm-hmm. I'm trying to understand what is the opposition to this bill when there are, as you have clearly articulated, there is a method for determining who will be able to enroll or be appointed or have the opportunity to engage in one of these programs.
Yeah. Okay. I think Mr. Neely wanted to kind of address that.
Chair Posansky, Senator Manning, I think the answer to that is the practice that's happening in Washington County isn't the same practice that happens in every county. The practice varies substantially. And that last piece that Mr. McLean described of a judge listening to everybody and saying, I don't care what you say, district attorney, we're going to move forward and put this person into that FSAP program anyway, that's not happening in most of the counties. In most of the counties, if the district attorney, and again, I agree with everything he described leading up to that last piece is what's happening in most counties. Probation and parole or the defense attorney or the DA are recommending individuals for the program. They're vetting that throughout all of those bodies. And in most counties, if the district attorney says, no, I do not believe this person, not because they're ineligible. If they're ineligible, that is universal. I don't believe they're a good fit, maybe because their prior criminal history is so significant or they believe it's a risky person. At that point, in most of the counties, mm-hmm. the conversation would stop. It would not be presented to the judge for a decision at that point. That's my understanding of how it's working in most counties. We would like to see that practice continue in those counties in which that is how it is occurring, recognizing that's not how it's happening in every county. And it may be after this testimony, that's not how it's happening in any county after they hear about this. But because of that, we would be more comfortable if, as Mr. McLean just said, and this would certainly help him in Washington County, if you choose to make it crystal clear that the judge has the final decision on this, that you then include some sideboards as to the prior criminal history. If you don't do that, it's going to be too expansive, and judges are going to feel like there may be some cases where you have serious violent previous criminal histories where those folks ought to be eligible, and that would probably be a fairly different position than the district attorney in most of those cases. So I hope that answers your question.
Well, again, I'm still, even as you define it, there are levels involved in it. Recommendations coming from different sources, from the district attorney's office, the defense. Everybody is putting in a recommendation as to whether or not this person should qualify for it or not. But I heard you also mention that a judge could decide to go off on their own, and which judges do. That's what they. That's why we have the judges there. They don't necessarily have to agree with anybody. And maybe the judge may find something a little bit more compelling to put a person in a particular program. So I'm still trying to grapple with what is the problem. I don't see a problem here.
Let me do this. First of all, we're not going to move the bill today. We're going to take some more testimony today, and we're going to have a few more questions, I understand, and then we're going to kind of regroup. So what I think at this point, Senator Manning, I'm going to ask that ODAA make contact with you so you can have a more detailed conversation on this, and hopefully that will help assist you as we move forward on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right.
Senator Denbrough?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And actually, it's I'm going down the same road, I think, as my colleague is. And I think it's maybe we're dealing with a philosophical issue here. I mean, I think, we elect district attorneys to be aggressive, appropriate pursuers of public interest, of course, and I believe that they do that. We elect judges to be impartial arbiters, weighing, the district attorney's argument, the defense attorney's argument, and doing their own sort of research through their staff. Try to get to an understanding, but what works for this case? And it seems like in a case such as this, what we're looking at here, that is who we want making that decision, doing the balance test that we expect of that individual. And it seems to me that that's what this bill is doing in that, sub 3B here is, by putting it in the hands of the court. Similar, it seems, to what's going on in Washington County. Mm-hmm. And so, I do, however we deal with this in terms of sideboards, I think, I really, it makes sense to me that we go down that road and have the judge be the arbiter in this case, rather than one side, in this case the district attorney, have sort of veto power over the decision of whether somebody can get into the program or not. I mean, am I reading this correctly?
Mr. Chair, Senator Denbrough, I think so. And I think that if that's the path that the committee chooses to go down, we could probably still live with this bill if you just put some sideboards in. I think we'd be comfortable with that. There just are no sideboards as this is currently written. So we're happy to engage in that discussion. And again, hopefully there could be, I think some, we could probably come to some, I don't think our request for sideboards is going to be really that aggressive. It's just those really serious violent offenses. We would just prefer to have those taken off the table just because that type of prior criminal history is really hard to overcome. For the DAs, right. Frankly, for the victims.
Okay. Senator Thatcher, did you have a question at this point?
No, I'm going to pass. Thank you.
All right, so let me just put one more out there, and this doesn't have to be answered now because we are going to have a little small work group. Okay. It seems to me that we have one county, Washington County, that we have a different perspective of how it's being implemented. It seems to me I would call that the pilot program compared to the other counties. And so one of the things I guess I would like to know, and it doesn't have to be today, what, if any, let's say, different outcomes have we seen in the sense of any of those unfortunate poster child situations where the judge has made that discretionary call and it has actually allowed someone to do something that we would not be appreciating? So why don't y'all ponder that, and then we're going to have a little work group together, and we'll be looking at the differences of the bills, and I'll be very frank with you. What I'm hearing from this committee, it seems to me that the portion that's on page 2, giving the court the discretion
to exercise use of this program is more than likely going to be part of the final project. I think we should, in fact, look at the person felony area. I think that's where you want to see some sideboards, and I think we can probably come up with something that hopefully everyone would agree with. All right. With that, if there's not anything else, I'm going to go ahead and call up our last of our individuals for this, and that's Jeremiah Stromberg. While Jeremiah's coming up, was there anyone else who did not sign up who wanted to give testimony on 3380A? I think I'm going to ask why she didn't sign up. It's becoming much more frequent as a non-sign-up.
So true.
All right. I think I want to do it this way. Gail, I want you to go first. I know you like to do the closing, but you're not going to get to do that today. And we'll let Jeremiah, who signed up as neutral, go last.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, supporting 3380. I just wanted to pull up 10,000 feet for a moment and just pose this a 10,000-foot view of this issue between the two bills and who decides whether it should be the judge or it should be the district attorney. Historically, when our system of justice was created and there was balance of power, the district attorney had unfettered discretion to choose which crimes to charge and allege. They could charge one, they could max it out and go for five or six if they could stretch it out that far. They could choose a misdemeanor, they could choose a felony, given the fact that some of the variables might match both. But they get to choose, and that's unreviewable. They get to choose the charges. They get to choose the plea bargain. It's totally up to the district attorney to decide, am I going to give you a misdemeanor? I'm going to make you plead to a felony. What is my plea bargain? There is no check and balance on the district attorney's power with respect to what charge and how to plea bargain. The counterbalance to that historically has always been the judge made the sentencing decision. That was the counterbalance to the unfettered discretion of the district attorney to choose the severity of the charges and the severity of the plea bargain. It was the judge. That was the counterbalance. That was the safety valve. All this debate is beautiful from our perspective of what you're grappling with. The question here really is, haven't we, with guidelines and mandatory minimums, put too much now power with the DA because they can control all that and shift it back to the court? So we see this as a debate of going back to historical balance, and we think it's a good thing to do.
Thank you. Jeremiah.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremiah Stromberg, Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Corrections. I have the responsibility to oversee the administration of this program, and we helped develop the pilot in the five counties. I will share with you that my testimony has changed a lot over the last hour, so maybe I'll start with answering a couple of the questions that I heard raised on the record. First, Senator Lithicum, you're absolutely right. As you heard the stats from Marion County, we have 16,000 probationers. If 70% of them have children, that's 11,000 probationers. The program has a maximum capacity of 120 individuals. It does not mean that other parents aren't being supported or treated or receiving resources. This program allows a caseload of 30-1 with a parole officer. That's half of what our state averages for an officer. Therefore, you're able to do twice as much. Thus why we use the term intensive supervision within this program, DHS and parole and probation working combined. If you remove the sideboards that are in place, as you have heard about this morning, the program will reach maximum capacity and will have a very long waiting list, or those that did not receive an opportunity to go into the program under the current size. Counties would have an option to either dedicate some of their own resources, justice reinvestment money, or come and ask for an expansion financially of the program to allow more participation. Senator Przanski, you asked about the differences between Washington County and the other counties. It is early for us to look at a lot of outcomes, but what I can tell you is of the 75 participants in the first year, two of them were revoked and sent to prison. I'd have to look at which counties they came out of, but I will tell you that at this point in time, the early indication is that we're seeing a high level of success, regardless of the front-end model of how individuals enter the program. And lastly, what I'd want to share, and it certainly speaks to some of the questions that Senator Manning and Senator Dembro raised, is that ultimately, as the administrator of this program, if an individual is eligible to be deported from prison and put on probation, we would prefer to see no sideboards that then prevent probation department from utilizing this program if it is the most intensive and responsive program for the individual. As Shannon White testified, currently the person's departed, and then the probation office sort of decides where best to fit the person, other than maybe in some of the Washington County cases. And that her hope would be that through this bill, what you see is the court takes a more active role in knowing about the program when making those decisions up front, as opposed to an after the fact. If the court does that, we will be able to track data more directly related to whether or not a person received this program in lieu of prison and be able to tie it to our prison numbers. Short of that, it is very difficult to know whether or not the individual would have been on probation or not. But ultimately, from our oversight of the program, is we don't want any sideboards that if you are eligible to be deported and the court determines we're putting you on probation, we want to be able to use full access to this program and all others to be able to support the individual. And with that, I'm happy to answer any additional questions.
All right. I'm going to not take questions at this point. I think we've pretty well aired this. I appreciate you giving us that commentary, because that is kind of like the baseline for the work group that we're going to be doing. And so, Jeremiah, I would like for you to be part of that work group.
Absolutely.
And we'll figure out other participants. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and have Jeremiah stay where you're at. I'm going to go ahead and close the House Bill 3380A public hearing. And I'm going to go ahead and reopen up House Bill 3438A. And, Jeremiah, you're the last I have on that one for testimony.
Great. Well, thank you, Senator Przanski, Chair Przanski, and members of the committee. Again, Jeremiah Stromberg, Assistant Director with the Department of Corrections. I am here to provide information as it relates to House Bill 3438A. As you heard from Representative Sanchez, we did work with her around some amendments to this bill. Transitional housing and residential treatment are two very important factors that should be considered when we are deciding where to release one of our inmates to back in the community. And there are other factors, some of which are outlined in the statute that's being amended, such as victim safety, the safety of the inmate upon release. Some communities, it would not be appropriate to send them back in for their own well-being and their best chance for success, as well as where their family supports are and other considerations. And so outlining transitional housing and residential treatment in the statute helps clarify reasons that both the Board of Parole and DOC will be taking under consideration. And she spoke to potential amendments coming forward, and the Department of Corrections is committed to tracking any and all data that would be helpful for continuing to look at where individuals move upon release from prison. And I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Senator Lithicum.
With regard to the county of conviction or where the offense was committed and the residing within 6 months, it seems like the testimony that we heard was with regard to the problems and the criminal behavior that they're familiar with in the environment or county where this is originating. The burden, the cost burden, moving to transitional housing in some other county as an alternative factor, has there been any math or study on what that might look like?
Chair Przanski, Senator Lithicum, I don't know that we have that data. We are, based on this bill, we have asked our research department to pull the migration of those leaving our institutions and where they're moving within the state so that we can start to get a better understanding of what that movement looks like. We do know that it's a handful of counties that truly are resource rich, if you will, that the majority of releasing inmates are hoping to get into: Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington, Marion, Lane. And yet we have to balance that with they have a large population that they need to serve and meet the needs of as well, and to prevent waiting lists within their own counties. So we're trying to look at the data. What I can share with you also, as a former member of the Board of Parole who had to make decisions around movements, it was only about one case a year during my term that the board truly had to become involved and say, we are moving this individual here. The counties work this issue collaboratively. They do conditional agreements that we're going to allow them to move to another county, and provided they're compliant, they can stay. But if they continue to violate or fall into the same patterns, then the original county has to take them back. And this allows some safeguards and allows us to control and balance what that movement looks like. So I don't know if that fully answered your question, but we're attempting to look at those data outcomes to see what the impacts are.
Very good. Quick follow-up. Is there a method today to acquire that data? And then the other part that I'm wondering about is how many individuals leave state?
Chair Przanski, Senator Lithicum, there is not a mechanism currently to track that data. It's not an area that we input into our computer system, and so the commitment on the part of the Department of Corrections would be that our release counselors will have to flag these and track them. It'll probably start as an Excel spreadsheet for us to be able to begin looking at how many movements. As far as movement out of state, what I can share with you is that we have on average 1,200 offenders a year move out of state that we are supervising or co-supervising with other states. And we have about the same amount that move into the state each year.
Okay.
All right. Jeremiah, thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 3438A? Not seeing anyone, close that public hearing. We're going to go ahead and open up public hearing on House Bill 2734A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2734A applies to small claims proceedings conducted in a circuit court. The bill allows one spouse to appear on behalf of the other spouse in a small claims mediation or litigation if the appearing spouse has the written consent of the other spouse or makes a declaration under penalty of perjury. There is a -A8 amendment before you today that applies this same rule to small claims proceedings that are conducted in a justice court. With the -A8 amendments, House Bill 2734 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, thank you. Jeff?
Thank you, Senator, for holding this hearing. My name is Jeff Merrick. I've been since 2012 volunteering at the Small Claims Court. I've done probably over 100 mediations there. I've seen some problems with the way it's conducted. I sent a package of reforms. I offered a package of reforms. One of them, this one, made it through the House. And just a quick summary, small claims is up to $10,000. For some people, this is a huge deal. Most of the clients there, customers, people are struggling. That's why they're there. It's bill collectors. So some of these people, if they get a garnishment, they're on the street. If somebody takes 25% of their wages, they are on the street. They're going to be homeless. So even though it's called small claims, these are some huge consequences for the people who appear there. So every year it has a big, important consequences. So quick points as to why this part is really undisputably good. You don't need two spouses to show up. You've got a medical debt. They name husband and wife. Do you really need husband and wife to show up to negotiate a solution? You don't. One can represent the other. Number two, it's really unfair because right now the hospitals, for example, they don't show up. They have paid professional collection agents show up for them. You can't have your husband show up for the wife. So as unfair as it is now. Number two, it's a hardship. These people are already hurting financially. And if they both happen to work or one happens to work, they both have to show up and they miss some of their paycheck is less next time around because they have to show up for mediation. And then if they don't settle, they have to show up for trial, both of them. Or they have child care issues. And so it just doesn't make sense. It puts these people in a deeper hole, and it just doesn't make sense to require both spouses to show up to these things. And I think that's why the House voted 59-0 to support at least this one reform to small claims.
All right, Senator Manning.
Real briefly, Mr. Chair, I don't know if disclosure is necessary, but I did do mediation for Lane County Circuit Court for a number of cases, and I do agree with everything that he said, and I will be supporting this bill.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I didn't have anyone else, but I'll ask if anyone does want to testify on 2734A. Not seeing anyone, we'll close that, and we do have everything ready to go when we need the dash 8. We're going to open up a work session on House Bill 2734A. Need a motion, please, on the dash A8s.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash A8 amendments to House Bill 2734A.
Thank you. Senator Thatcher moves the dash A8 amendments into House Bill 2734A. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2734A as amended with the A8s to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thanks. And we now have a motion before us to move the bill, House Bill 2734A, as amended by the dash A8s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Again, discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Manning, I assume you'd like to carry this one.
Yes, sir.
We'll close the work session on the Senate Bill 2734A. And at this point, we're going to open up our last of our public hearings on House Bill 2630A.
Whitney? Thank you, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. House Bill 2630A makes changes to proceedings involving guardians and protected persons. For instance, it specifies procedures to change the abode of a protected person and requires petitions for appointment of a fiduciary to include why less restrictive alternatives are inadequate. There are no amendments, and there is a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
All right, great. I have Bob Juntoff scheduled to give testimony. Was there anyone else who wants to testify on 2638? Why don't you come on up, please? And Bob, I'll let you get started. Just to get started, we have about 8 to 10 minutes, and I have a couple other things I'd like to try to get done today, if possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bob Juntoff. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon. We are the state's protection and advocacy organization. We've been advocating on behalf of individuals with disabilities since the 1970s. Part of our work is advocating for people who come into contact with the guardianship process. Through state law, we are notified when a person when there's a petition in a guardianship proceeding to place them in a restrictive setting, or a guardian wishes, after they've become a guardian, to do so. This means that for the last 17 years, we have been in contact with many people who have protective proceedings that affect their lives. Just very quickly, to remind you that in a protective proceeding, an adult's right to control where they live and how they conduct their life is transferred to someone else because a court has found that that person is incapable of taking care of those needs themselves. The law is very specific that a finding of a need for a guardian does not take away a person's civil rights more broadly. The guardianship is supposed to pursue the interests of the protected person and to involve the protected person as much as possible in the process. This bill comes out of our experience in talking to individuals who have had guardians appointed for them and hearing their concerns. The goal is to make the process more open so that those individuals can have their voices heard within the process. So there are some provisions that allow them to be notified in certain circumstances, to have an opportunity to voice their concerns to the court, and to have notice. In the entire course of working this bill, we've had a work group that came up with the language you see today. There is some concern from Guardians Association that having a 30-day notice provision before an individual's place of abode or placement is changed would not be appropriate. This notice provision is in the statute as the result of complaints from individuals who have been precipitously moved. In other words, had a person arrive at their place of abode, their home, and transfer them that day to other places without any notice or explanation. And those folks under present law don't have an opportunity to complain about that or to have their protests heard. And so what we're trying to do in this particular provision is to require notice, except that, and again, this language was worked on through in a work group that included the state attorney general and public guardians from Multnomah County as well as the state, that the guardian would actually have authority to, in essence, waive that notice requirement if there is a need to do so to protect that individual. And so this is not a hard requirement. What it does, in essence, is it tells the guardian, look, if you're going to move somebody, you should let that person know. And if they have objections, if they have concerns, they should be able to let the court know about it with the understanding that a move might have to happen sooner. But that they would still have an opportunity to have their voice heard, even if it has to happen after the move. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And if you would please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, good morning, Senator Prezansky, members of the committee. My name is Christian Hale, and I'm here as a vice president and board member of the Oregon Guardian Conservator Association. I draw your attention, please, to recently submitted meeting material through exhibit on the website, through OLIS submitted by our president, Tim McNeil. And in there, he explains our board's position against House Bill 2630 as written, as mentioned, and also as shown in the exhibit, due to the restriction on guardian operations that would result from a full 30 days notice each time a move would be required under the specific way that this bill is written. The Guardian Conservator Association is primarily concerned about this notice because the way that this bill is presented overall seems to presume that all guardianships are contested. Additionally, the bill seems to presume that guardians do not involve persons, their protected persons, in decisions affecting their lives, including placement of in a new residence or a change of abode. As you may know, there are many guardians across Oregon, the vast majority of which, I believe, are family guardians and not professionals. However, the Guardian Conservator Association is primarily comprised of professional guardians who make it their business to serve people who are deemed to be incapacitated by a court and also financially incapable, if that is the case for some of those. And they serve where either a family member is not available or is not suitable to serve as a guardian for that protected person. Again, our association operates through its members in pretty much every county in Oregon, and we have over 100 members, each of whom serves many protected persons. I'm happy to answer any general questions as to the nature of our objection at this point, but I can also speak to the specific language that we have concerns about.
And what I'm going to do is this, yes. Christian, I'm going to ask you to put that in writing. We're not moving the bill today. I'm just trying to get the testimony in, and since you have specific detailed stuff, it'd be better for it to be recorded so we will be able to work through that.
Certainly.
All right. Any questions on the general part? If not, we're going to move into another arena. Gentlemen, thank you all very much. I appreciate your time. And Christian, if you'll follow up with that, and if you could have it turned in to us today is Tuesday by the end of the week. Thursday would be a great time to give us an opportunity to have that, and we'll get this rescheduled for work session next week, more than likely.
Very good. Thank you, Senator.
All right, thank you. So with that, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2630A. What I'm going to do is jump down to our work sessions. I'm going to ask that we're going to open up a work session for House Bill 2618A. And the purpose for opening it up, I'd like to have Kevin Campbell, as well as Matt Marquis, to come forward. And we're going to talk briefly about some differences that
we have in the proposals. I want to get this out there so members can have a working understanding, so when we actually start looking at maybe trying to work the bill, we all know where everyone's at. All right, so the issue, I guess, here at this point is not only it sounds to me that the parties have agreed that, yes, there needs to be an increase at this point. The question is, besides having an increase, how should we prepare for the future? In the sense, should we have a COLA that would actually set the demarcation automatically, or should we look at some other alternative of maybe having a fixed rate to be advanced to, everyone knowing in 2 years, 3 years, whatever that time is, that's going to be the new rate, or should we just have everything come back as we traditionally have done and have a presentation whenever the, in this case, the sheriffs felt that they were in need to raise the fees. So we're going to kind of open it up and just kind of get some perspective from either of you so we can just put that on the record.
You want me to go ahead?
Please. Great. Chair Przanski and members of the committee, first of all, Kevin Campbell here on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I want to thank the committee for giving us an opportunity to have this discussion and reach a resolution to this. As you know, the last time the sheriffs came forward to seek an increase in these fees was 2009. I don't think that was because the increased cost to them over time wasn't occurring. I think it was just they didn't come back. I've, as you know, started to represent the sheriffs last session, and so I think their intent would be to try to keep up with some of the costs of living. So when you wait for that period of time between 2009 and today and try to then bring fees back up, especially when they're already under market rate significantly, there is a loss of revenue during that time that's picked up somewhere. As you know, this is for civil actions. So it's specific services that the sheriffs do in a wide range of proceedings, including serving summons, subpoenas, citations, orders. And so they have a cost, and the cost is under the market rate. If you look at, you know, the private process servers, their rates are quite a bit higher. So our goal would be to make sure that the cost and the fees just stay up. If we have large delays, of course, the income is foregone then during that period, in this case, between 2009 and today. So we were not opposed to, because I know that the debt collectors that Matt represents, we're opposed to a COLA provision. I wasn't entirely sure all of the details to that because I know a lot of their folks use private process servers, but I think that one of the solutions that the chair brought forward as an option would be to look at a sunset provision. So we, in essence, try this for a period of time. If you put a five-year sunset on it, the office, the Department of Administrative Services Office of Economic Analysis has agreed to do the calculation, and that would give us the ability to kind of to look at it over time. I had not considered just setting a straight increase amount. I'm not opposed to looking at that either, but thank you.
So, yeah, what we're going to do, you two are going to have an opportunity to kind of discuss this in greater detail. We'll have Whitney will probably be sitting in just to kind of help facilitate. But, Matt, if
so we don't fight.
No, you know, not necessarily.
No.
With the time that she has, you know, she'll participate at whatever level necessary. But, Matt, I think the one thing I'd like for you to put on the record as to your concern as to how the COLA would work with the rounding up of the amount, I just want to get that on the record because this is something that could actually have a not a significant, but the increases could be greater than cost of living.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing the Oregon Collectors Association, and to the chair's point, the way that this is written, first of all, if cost of living were to go down, and I'm not saying that it will go down over the next 5 or 6 years, but if it were, first of all, the fee would never go down under this scenario. It also rounds everything up to the nearest dollar. And I understand from accounting purposes why that might be a good thing, but as you are building cost of living from 1 year to the next year off of whatever your fee is, is today, and then a year later, that fee. When you round things up, you start to compound things. And so if you take easy math and you take a $10 fee, for instance, and all of a sudden, if cost of living were only to go up 1%, but you're actually going to increase that a dollar, all of a sudden, that's a 10% increase. And then the next year, you're at $11. And again, you're going to be looking at another 10% increase. And so by rounding everything up over a six-year period, I think is what this is at, from a five to six-year period, essentially you could almost double, depending on what cost of living actually does over that time period, you might actually be double what cost of living is. And so that is some of our concerns, the way that this is set up. Nothing else in our judicial system, at least to my knowledge, really has a built-in cost of living increase to their fees. One example where this kind of came up a couple of years ago, again, to the chair's point, when we looked at justice court fees 2 years ago, one of those fees, they actually were able to build in our negotiations another increase set for some future time period. And so that was in House Bill 2316 from the 2015 session. It's in ORS 51310. And they built in an increase. It went from $28 to $35. And then at a set year later, it went up another $2. And so if the committee decides that we need to increase fees again, and again, we are totally neutral on the bill as it is before you, we may disagree that these fees are market rate or not. My clients tend to think that private sector is pretty well tied to the sheriff's fees and nobody is going out of business today. But if you are looking at some sort of future increase, trying to set something out maybe 5 or 6 years, and even if you base that off of cost of living, at least then you wouldn't be compounding a not quite true cost of living figure.
Okay. So I just want to get that on the record, and y'all can be, as certified smart people, to be able to sit down and kind of work through this and see if we can come up with a better meeting of the minds. All right. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2618. House Bill 2616A, we do not have the fiscal on it. We've been waiting to see if it was coming in. It's not here. And there's also a couple of points I need to check with individual members. So we're not going to be taking any action on that because we don't have the paperwork for the first part. And then I just need to do some follow-up. The last one we have everything ready to go. I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2920A. Whitney?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, you previously heard House Bill 2920A on May 3rd. It specifies procedures for obtaining a satisfaction document from a judgment creditor and award of attorney's fees. We also had in, at the time of the hearing, the -A2 amendment, which replaces the measures and makes the procedures applicable to the execution sale of real property. On the -A2, there is no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, thank you. Senator Thatcher?
Do you want to move the A2s?
Yes.
I might understand. Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the A2 amendments to House Bill 2920A.
Senator Thatcher moves the A2 amendments for House Bill 2920A. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2920A as amended with the A2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves House Bill 2920A as amended by the A2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Again, discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Any volunteers on this one? Senator Lithicum?
Did I volunteer?
I'm just asking.
Sure, I'll do it.
All right. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2928. And colleagues, thank you very much. We'll be back tomorrow at 8:15. And with that, we're adjourned. And with that, we're adjourned.